Welcome to another episode of the Gunblog Variety Cast with your hosts, Sean Sorrentino and Aaron Paulette.
Welcome to episode 171 of Gunblog Variety Cast Radio, a proud member of the Self-Defense Radio Network. How are you doing, Aaron?
I am doing my best to avoid slipping into a turkey coma. We have our big Thanksgiving meal at lunch because Mom is a dedicated afternoon napper. So we eat and she goes to bed, and then dinner is leftovers.
Right. So we should point out to everybody that we are, in fact, recording this on Thanksgiving. We're taking time out of our family Thanksgiving and recording this podcast because we love you guys.
Because we're hardcore, man.
Or really, that's the only time we had.
Pretty much. So yeah, we're squeezing this in after I've eaten, but before Sean has eaten.
Yep. My wife is roasting a chicken for me. Oh, I am so looking forward to this. I love my wife's roasted chicken. Of course, I love pretty much anything my wife cooks. I didn't get fat by eating bad food, but I'm really looking forward to my roasted chicken.
Chicken on Thanksgiving is mildly heretical, and I expect you're going to get some hate mail for that.
I don't really give a damn. There's only two of us eating, so why should I break out a big old giant turkey and have... No, I can get turkey breast or something at the... No. Give me a nice roasted chicken. Plus, you've never had my wife's roasted chicken.
That is correct. Mm-mm.
That's some good stuff.
So the only things of real note that have happened lately. First of all, I had a great recording with Geeks, Gadgets, and Guns last week. I talked for like 2 hours with these guys, and we all just completely nerded out. It was glorious. Mm-hmm. That episode should drop on Monday. So after you finish listening to this, go and check out their podcast and listen to mine, because I'm awesome like usual. The other thing I have to report is that, well, about 2 weeks ago, a friend of the show, Charles Lee Scudder, sent me an air rifle. And I'm going to talk more about air rifles as part of my podcasting segment. But I wasn't able to shoot it because it's a break barrel. And that means I couldn't take it to the county range because they're really, really anal about constantly pointing the barrel downrange, as they should be. And there's just no way for me to break it and cock it and load it without significantly, you know, going off staying in my lane. I don't even know what the proper term is. But yeah, the barrel would just be all over the place. And so I knew that I couldn't shoot it there, so I'd have to shoot it in the backyard. But I needed a proper backstop for it. This particular air rifle shoots at 1,300 feet per second, which is really strong for air rifles. Most air rifles are somewhere in like the 500, 600 FPS range. And so I'm looking for traps, and all the traps I find for air rifles are designed for that feet per second. If I shoot it using the pellets I have, I'll poke holes in it. So I have to do some calculations, and I eventually decide that the only trap that's going to work is a trap for 22 rimfire.
Yeah, I know your pain.
Yeah, on the one hand, it's expensive and it's heavy. On the other hand, now that I have a trap for 22 rimfire, this thing will last for freaking ever against my air gun pellets. And so I had a lot of fun shooting that this week, and that has spurred my blue collar prepping segment for today. So how was your week, Sean? Anything unusual to report?
Well, I am on vacation all of this week and almost all of next week. I do have to work on Friday. I am basically doing nothing for 2 weeks. And it is lovely. I've walked the dog. I have binge watched a whole bunch of Netflix. I've gotten to hang out with my wife. I get to play with the dog. It's pretty nice.
It's not just doing nothing. You're being paid to do nothing.
Well, you know, I did the work. I may as well get the vacation time, right?
Exactly.
So tell us about our lovely sponsors, Aaron.
Thanks to Lucky Gunner and Remington for their support of Gunblog Variety Cast Radio. From Golden Saber to Range Rounds, get a full lineup of quality Remington ammo that ships fast at LuckyGunner.com.
All right, let's get on with the show.
Beth is on assignment, probably a turkey assignment with her family, and will return next week.
This podcast runs on your donations. Go to GunblogVarietyCast.com and click on the Donate or Subscribe button in the right sidebar. You can make a one-time donation of any amount or subscribe for as little as $2 a month. That doesn't sound like much, but we pay our server costs monthly. A little help from you is a big help to us.
Felons behaving badly. Burglar shot by Harnett County resident had just tried to kill someone. Dateline Lillington, North Carolina. Harnett County deputies believe a resident shot and subdued a burglar on Sunday who had tried to kill someone in a shooting earlier the same night, authorities said. About 9 p.m., victim 1, 40, of Lillington, was shot four times as he stood outside a home on Evren McNeil Street in the RNT Mobile Home Park in Bunlevel, according to Harnett County Sheriff's Office. Several rounds struck an occupied vehicle nearby, but the person in the car was not harmed, deputies said. Victim 1 was taken to Central Harnett Hospital, then transferred to Wake Med, where he is in critical condition, deputies said. Less than an hour later, 911 dispatchers received a call from a resident of Lorraine Lane in Lillington saying that someone had been breaking into the caller's home and the caller had shot the burglar, deputies said. Deputies identified the man shot in the incident as suspect, 21, of Lillington. He suffered one gunshot wound, deputies said. Suspect was taken to UNC Medical Center, where he is listed in stable condition. Investigators believe that suspect was the person who had committed the shooting in the mobile home park, deputies said. Deputies have secured warrants against suspect for one count of assault with a deadly weapon with intent to kill, inflicting serious injury, and six counts of shooting into an occupied vehicle in relation to the incident at the mobile home park. Deputies secured warrants against suspect for one count of first-degree burglary for the incident in which he was shot.
All right, so he's 21, he's a young man. Clearly, this was just a bad choice. And he's got a good heart for the most part. This is just a one-time thing, right?
Suspect, second-degree trespass, misdemeanor class 3. Disorderly conduct, misdemeanor class 2. Wanton injury to personal property, $200 and less, misdemeanor class 2. Communicating threats, misdemeanor class 1. And possession with intent to sell, schedule 6, felon class I.
I also noticed that you didn't give the victim's name, which is kind of unusual. You know, the first person he shot, like, four times. Is there a reason for that, Sean?
Well, two counts drug paraphernalia use possess, misdemeanor class 3. Two counts possession with intent to sell, schedule 6, felon class I. And possession of a firearm by a felon, felon class G.
So they're both drug dealers, maybe? Is that where this is going?
Well, I can't say that for certain, Aaron, but as Adam used to say, humans are pattern-matching creatures. And I can't say for sure we have a pattern here, but maybe we do. Risk versus reward is an important consideration in the tech world as well as in real life. Baron is back to talk about doing a proper risk assessment in
Tech Tips,
Tech Tips, Tech Tips.
You are damaging my calm.
Tech Tips with the Baron.
Hey, kids, I'm back. And this week, we're going to talk about something that actually spans from just the tech world and into the real world. We're going to talk about risk and risk assessment. Because one of the things I've noticed lately is people are doing things in the tech world largely because they haven't fully evaluated the risk. And oftentimes, when you point out an immediate point of risk, such as bad PR, all of a sudden, attitudes regarding different security choices suddenly matter, and you go, you know what? Actually, taking the time and effort to do that is probably a good thing. So we're going to talk about risk assessment. When you look at different things, we're going to use a really popular example from the news right now. Amazon has a product that they're going to basically allow Amazon delivery drivers to open your front door and deliver you a package. On the front, that actually seems like a good idea. And the reason it seems like a good idea is because package theft is a very big deal. The thing is from a risk assessment standpoint, I can deal with a package being stolen. I cannot deal with a stranger having access to my house. It doesn't matter if they have cameras and they know theoretically who had access. The thing is I am providing somebody else keys, and not just keys, but arbitration to allow other people to have access to my property. This isn't a good thing. And not only is it not a good thing, it's one of those things that if they had looked at the entire problem set, there are better ways to solve the problem. For example, why instead of unlocking the front door to my house, do you not just unlock a locker that has been securely mounted in place next to my door? You don't have to get into my house, but you now have a secure place to leave the package. Even more than that, why don't you guys go back to requiring signatures for packages of value? I remember when I had a sign for a $1,000 computer. Nowadays, you just go and leave that crap sitting on my doorstep where anyone can run off with it. This is what I'm talking about with risk assessment. What is the potential outcomes and negative consequences for the current behavior, and what is the solutions to those problems? And with those solutions, are there additional problems you're creating? Amazon, for example, while they claim that their system would be secure, I came across a news article tonight from the Technology Review. Evidently, some of the underlying technology has already been compromised and hacked by researchers. So before they're even fully out of the gate, someone's found a loophole. And this is the problem. Technology is a wonderful tool, but people are abusing it in ways that they really, really shouldn't be. And to quote Jeff Goldblum, you spent a lot of time asking whether or not you could, but no one bothered to ask the important question of whether or not you should. And when it comes to getting smart devices and hooking things up to the internet, you should really ask yourself, do the benefits really benefit you in a way that the risks are worth the reward? And you'll find if you actually start thinking about that, a lot of things, that's a no. There are other things that, if properly handled, the risks are mitigated and it's not really that big of a deal. And even then, it could still be beneficial. But in the grand scheme of things, letting some random stranger come through your front door to drop off a package, not worth it. And going one step further, this also comes to behavior in the real world. There are things that we could do or not do. Some are more risk than others. If you take those risks, you understand and acknowledge the possible outcomes. So for example, going to some random website and entering your credit card number, well, if you don't know who's actually on the other end, they can just run off with your credit card. Going and handing out your cell phone number. Now, here's a fun one. A lot of people wouldn't think much about telephone numbers, but in the modern age, your telephone number is actually becoming fairly precious, and it's becoming precious because it's getting tied to our identity. It follows us around, and pretty much from the time we get our first phone number, we aren't really getting rid of them anymore. It used to be whenever you would move, you get a new phone number, but with the advent of cell phones, the number just follows us everywhere. And we use that phone number for doing two-factor authentication, and that's the number where banks, insurance companies, that they know how to contact us through that number, and we willingly hand that thing out like candy. Again, this comes back to the whole risk versus reward, and a lot of people haven't even acknowledged that there's a risk there, but it's definitely happening. So whenever you're doing something, just think about the risks. If you're getting a new piece of technology, especially in the IoT space, think about, is the risk versus the reward? What could possibly be negative out of this? And with that, I wish you guys a happy Thanksgiving.
Baron still blogs at the-minuteman.org.
Miguel is on assignment.
Hey gang, this is Masad Ayoub from the Pro Arms Podcast. I'm here to remind you that our podcast is a member of the Self-Defense Radio Network. And I'm going to suggest you do what we do and check out the other podcasts at selfdefenseradio.net.
The main topic, Giffords! Exclamation point, goes after muzzleloaders. I don't know if you get them, Aaron, but I keep getting emails from the Gabby Giffords campaign to end gun ownership.
No, I don't. I opt out of those sorts of things.
Well, they've changed their name from, I think it was Americans for Responsible Solutions, to Giffords! Exclamation point, Courage to Fight Gun Violence.
What I think is funny is that in a lot of parlance, the exclamation point is referred to as a bang. Hence, the interrobang is the question mark followed by the exclamation point. So literally, you've got Giffords bang.
Okay.
And I'm just enough of a jerk to find that hilarious.
Maybe somebody told them that's why they dropped it. Giffords, Courage to Fight Gun Violence, sent out a, I don't know, position paper, a white paper. I don't know what we would actually call it, a report.
Breathless pearl clutching.
Yes, legal and lethal. 9 products that could be the next bump stock. I really dun, feel dun, like dun. I should like, yeah, I should totally like echo that. Legal and lethal. 9 products that could be the next bump stock. How the gun industry is putting public safety at risk by manufacturing extremely lethal firearms designed to skirt federal laws established to keep us safe.
In other words, how gun manufacturers comply with the letter of the law but still manage to make money.
there's that, and there's, you know, extremely lethal firearms as opposed to the only partially lethal firearms they let us have now. I don't know about you, but I don't buy firearms with the intention of them being less than lethal devices. Like, if I shoot a deer, I want the deer dead. If I shoot a person, I want him to stop doing whatever it is doing. And if he happens to die in the process, that's his problem. But I don't want it to tickle him. Let's not pretend that the weapons we have now are less than lethal and that it's possible to make them even more lethal or extremely lethal, as the white paper here says. So a couple of them are kind of silly. Binary triggers. How many people have ARs that have a trigger that fires when you pull it and when you let it go?
I didn't know that people actually bought that. I thought that was a novelty item.
I'm pretty sure it is. Then there's the trigger crank. We all know that a Gatling gun with a big hand crank on it, it's not actually a machine gun.
Right.
You can buy or build your own hand cranked Gatling gun. Now, if you attach your drill to the crank and like pull the drill trigger, now you have a machine gun. Literally, that's how the law is written. But putting a trigger crank on your AR or some other rifle, oh no, you have this thing that pulls the trigger multiple times. Now, how much accuracy are you going to get out of that?
Oh, gee, I don't even know how easily you can shoulder that thing and maintain your sight picture and then crank. That is very much a range toy for yeehaw, watch this. And I say that without judgment, mind you.
Well, there's nothing wrong with yeehaw, watch this.
No, not at all.
High capacity shotguns. Oh, no. Because we talked about this a while ago, how a shotgun is a bore diameter over half an inch if it's 12 gauge. And therefore, it's automatically a destructive device unless it has what's been referred to as a sporting purpose.
Right.
However, because many shotguns that fire large caliber shells are traditionally used for hunting, ATF is able to exempt certain models of shotguns suitable for sporting purposes from regulation under the NFA. They say this like it's a bad thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
Their complaint is that some of these high capacity shotguns will hold more shells than the standard hunting shotgun. It really says right in here, they're talking about the Street Sweeper, which was banned. It held 12 rounds, set off with a dash, significantly more than traditional hunting shotguns. I don't know how much you know about what's available in the tube-fed pump shotgun world, but I can go buy a Mossberg 590 and put 9 rounds in it. If I get the 20-inch barrel, it's a 9-round shotgun.
Well, yeah, but you have to go out of your way to look for those. I understand that the standard capacity for most shotguns is 6 in the tube, correct?
I don't know.
5 or 6?
I guess if you go buy yourself an 870 Express, 6 rounds in it's fine. Yeah, that's about right. But oh my goodness, high capacity shotguns, because, you know, those are extra lethal.
Yeah, because, you know, the first 6 or 7 shotgun rounds are okay, but that 8th or 9th round, that's super extra lethal beyond the pale.
Because, you know, if you have to shoot that many times at a bird or a deer, then you're not a real hunter. Because that's what the Second Amendment was designed for, right?
Yeah, because we all know that Washington crossed the Delaware to either hunt deer or ducks. Not sure which, depends on who's telling the story. But yes, definitely for hunting and not for fighting a war.
Now, we move on to number 4, AK and AR style pistols. Certain newer model pistols, like AK pistols and AR pistols, are designed so they can fire rifle rounds capable of penetrating body armor, but are concealable, like handguns. So, Aaron, stop laughing for a second. I've got a serious question here.
Right.
Right. So, yes. You are all dolled up in your girl garb.
Mm-hmm.
And I give you an AR pistol, and I say, Aaron, could you hide this for me? Would I have to drop down to a 20-round magazine, or could you conceal the full AR pistol with a 30-round magazine taped to your leg underneath your skirt?
Well, I think it would depend on how strictly you define the word conceal. I'm certain I could hide it under my skirt, but I would be getting very strange looks for what I was strapped with.
You'd probably have trouble walking.
Well, it depends on whether I strap it to the inside or the outside of my leg. The outside, I could walk a lot more easily, but it would really show. I could maybe get a bit more concealment, but not only would I walk funny, but the magazine and the pistol grip would stick out in not family-friendly areas, I would think.
And going right along with this pistol thing is the pistol arm brace. I know that they're upset that the ATF said, no, you can't have AR pistols with arm braces and then put them up against your shoulder because that's manufacturing a short barrel rifle. And then they took it back because it was a stupid statement to make. This is the best part, the line at the end. However, ATF's decision clearly fails to address the significant public safety threat posed by these arm braces.
Example needed?
That was kind of what I thought. It's an attachment that allows a shooter to fire a pistol with rifle-like accuracy. So I guess what they're saying is we shouldn't let people fire pistols that are accurate? Is that where we're going?
Well, I started to say shouldn't let people fire from the shoulder, but then she doesn't like just the regular pistols as well.
And they literally show a picture of somebody with the arm brace strapped to the arm, right? Not using it in the incorrect way, but actually using it as it was designed, strapped to the arm. The only thing I can take from this is that they're upset that pistols might be, like, really accurate.
Well, I think they're upset about a lot more than trying to couch it in very specific terms.
Number 6, AR pistol blade stabilizer. Yeah, that's not anything but a different type of shoulder brace, arm brace, whatever, so we can skip on that. Number 7, a perennial hobby horse, 50 caliber rifle and 50 caliber ammunition.
Now, is this the one where you can shoot through buildings, or is this the one where you can shoot down jumbo jets? I get confused on my talking points.
The sniper rifle is accurate at distances of a mile or more and considered a national security threat due to its capacity to shoot down a helicopter.
Because nothing else can shoot down a helicopter. Got it.
Well, helicopters don't actually fly. They just make a whole lot of noise and the earth rejects them. What really happens when you shoot a 50 caliber rifle at the helicopter is you make such a loud noise that it covers up the sound of the helicopter and the earth forgets to keep rejecting it. It has nothing to do with the bullet. It's just how loud it is.
Sure.
Hey, that's no stupider than any of the other stuff I see in this paper here.
Yeah, and you mentioned perennial favorite because they have been whining about 50 caliber rifles for, what, 10 years or more at this point, and I have yet to see any 50 caliber rifle used in any crime at all, ever.
Designed for use in military situations and used by military units across the world, these weapons can penetrate structures and destroy or disable light armored vehicles, radar dishes, stationary and taxiing aircraft, and other high-value military targets.
Okay, but here's the thing. Her entire platform is about civilian lives. I mean, I've never really heard her care much about military people. All she's mentioning here are military uses for this. It's not like she's saying you can shoot through cop cars.
It does go on, actually, Aaron.
Well, yeah, 50 caliber rifles could easily cause a mass casualty incident.
Oh, no, keep reading. It gets better.
Horrifically, the gun industry actively markets these weapons, which are legal in most U.S. states.
Horrifically?
Yes.
Horrifically. I'm going to skip number 8 because number 8 is what I'm really interested in. Number 9, specialized ammunition, incendiary rounds, and tracer rounds. Well, we all know that tracers are extra super dangerous because if you shoot somebody with a tracer and you miss, you can tell that you missed because the tracer doesn't go into them, so you can adjust fire on the target.
I was thinking maybe, you know, it's okay to shoot them, but you don't want to burn them.
You know, that's true. We were told never to shoot tracers on... There was some ranges we weren't allowed to use tracers on because they kept setting trees on fire. So, I mean, there's a fair point. You don't want to set your tree on fire. But armor-piercing rounds, because I'm not entirely certain why anybody cares about armor-piercing rounds, because what are you going to shoot that is needing armor-piercing rounds? All your rifle rounds will go right through a police vest. It's just, they're not designed for that. They're designed for pistol rounds. So, yeah. What kind of armor are we talking here? Who needs armor, except for, I guess, the president? That we need to be concerned about people having armor-piercing rifles. And you know what? If you're taking a pot shot at the president, I mean, if you're going to the point where you're going to get armor-piercing rounds and try to shoot through his limousine, you're probably not too concerned about getting it down at the local Dick's Sporting Goods.
Mm-hmm.
I really don't understand why they care that some bullets are a little harder than others.
Probably because they don't understand how body armor works and think that this type of ammunition will magically allow shooters to kill cops with bulletproof vests.
I could understand that if the person who wrote this wasn't senior policy advisor at Giffords, former ATF special agent David Chipman.
Oh, geez.
One would assume an ATF special agent would know enough to know what they are actually talking about when they talk about armor piercing.
Well, yeah, but this is the same ATF who, what, 3 years ago, were trying to ban that green tip ball ammo because it was armor piercing.
Yeah, they were banning it because they thought they could ban it, not because they thought there was any specific problem with it. They just wanted to take away stuff. They're like the Grinch.
You have just proven my point. That's why this ATF guy did it. It's not because of any concerns. It's because he wants to take things away.
I'm not giving them the benefit of the doubt. Well, they just don't know any better. No, they know better. They're just stupid. But the pièce de résistance, if you happen to be Pepe Le Pew, is number 8, muzzleloaders.
Oh, boy. You can't see this, but I am facepalming so hard right now.
Who was the Second Amendment written by, and what was the state of technology at the time the Second Amendment was written? Because we hear about this from the gun grabbers all the time. So what is the Second Amendment for?
According to popular wisdom, the Second Amendment was written at a time when the Founding Fathers could only conceive of black powder muzzle-loading rifles, and they couldn't imagine that we would have rapid-fire weapons or weapons that held multiple rounds. So clearly the Second Amendment really only applies to muzzle-loaders, and if the Founding Fathers could see what we have today, they would be appalled and say that it doesn't apply to that.
Even if you believe this, I can't use that kind of word on this podcast, but even if you believe that horse pucky, then I should just be able to go out and buy myself a muzzle loader like the Founding Fathers had and be cool, right?
The line I usually use is, okay, well, in that case, I'll do what they did in that time period and carry a brace of pistols. So you'd be okay if I had, oh, between 3 and 5 of these muzzle loading pistols strapped to my chest?
Their issue appears to be that it is legal for people to go and buy a muzzleloader without getting a background check. A single shot must be loaded through the muzzle, one shot every 3 minutes if you're trained, muzzleloader, and it doesn't have a background check.
That's because unless it's used in the commission of a crime, it's not legally a firearm, isn't that correct?
According to law, I think it's like 1896, anything 1896 and before, or 1895 and before, something like that. It's 120 years ago when it was built, or it's a replica, or it's a muzzle loader specifically. There's a carve out. I don't know what it is, but basically this is not a firearm. That's the law. Oh no, that's terrible. We can't have people getting one of these, I can only load it one time, and then I have to stand there with a ramrod and load it again type of weapons without a background check. These people are insane, Aaron.
Yeah, I mean, they make the claim here that you can buy a gun without a background check. But really, what it comes down to is they just don't want us to have guns, period. Because, well, like we just talked about before, gun grabbers make the claim that the Second Amendment was only about muzzleloaders, and here the Giffords campaign is complaining about muzzleloaders. So really, they just want to take away everything. They don't want us to have firearms. They don't want us to be able to defend ourselves. They want us to rely on the state for everything.
I can't improve on that, Aaron.
Tiffany recently appeared on the Polite Society podcast with fellow Rangemaster Certified Instructor Akil Kadir. She was so intrigued by his story that she asked if he would sit for an interview. It was spur of the moment, so Tiffany asks her patience with the less-than-stellar sound quality from her cell phone voice recorder. Here's part one of her conversation with Akil.
You never really understand a person until you consider things from his point of view. Until you climb inside of his skin, walk around in it.
I am pleased to be joined now by Mr. Akil Kadir of Citizens Safety Academy in Murfreesboro, Tennessee. And can you, for those who aren't familiar with your work, can you just give us a little bit of background on your training and what you're doing with Citizen Safety?
Citizen Safety Academy is a firearms training company that I formed in Middle Tennessee. And I've been working, getting into it and moving out of working, doing government work and law enforcement work. So it's hopefully my future, because I enjoy teaching people how to shoot and have been doing it for a long time.
And you are also instrumental in the creation of the Dory Miller Rifle and Pistol Club. Is that right?
Well, Dory Miller Rifle and Pistol Club was founded by my father in 1980, and I was raised in it. When I say I've been training for a long time, meaning I started at 14 years old, being the first instructor for his youth group.
So tell us about Dory Miller. First of all, who is Dory Miller, and why did your father decide on that name for his gun club?
Dory Miller was a World War II war hero, actually. He was instrumental in protecting a ship during the attack on Pearl Harbor. And the story is quite fascinating. He was a cook, very capable seaman, but he wasn't allowed to do certain things because of the racism or the Jim Crow or the caste system in America at the time.
Just to be clear, for those who don't know, Dory Miller was black, correct?
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, Dory Miller was African-American. So what happened was during the attack on Pearl Harbor, you know, the captain was injured. A lot of the people were injured, and he came from below the deck and manned a gun on the deck of the ship, and actually was instrumental in defending that ship against the attack from the fighters. And afterward, he was given several awards, and after that, went back out into war on another ship that was subsequently sunk, and he died. You know, he went down with the ship.
And his story was recently dramatized on the big screen, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think Cuba Gooding Jr. played him.
Yeah.
In the movie, yeah.
In the movie Pearl Harbor. At least there was some homage paid to him. It wasn't a full story about his life. That would be quite the movie. Maybe someone will make that movie soon.
That'd be nice.
Yeah, it would be. But, okay, so that's where the name comes from. Now tell us a little bit about the Dory Miller Rifle and Pistol Club, which is based in New York State.
Yeah, Buffalo, New York. My dad and another community organizer, a man named John Wiley, they decided that it would be a good idea to start an African-American gun club. Not one so exclusively for African-Americans, but one that would at least target African-Americans as an underserved demographic.
And you've recently endeavored to extend the Dory Miller Rifle Club tradition down here to Tennessee, right? You have a new club that will be opening membership soon. Is that right?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, my dad has been relocating, going back and forth between here and Buffalo, trying to keep the club going. And I said, hey, you know, we need to start a Dory Miller Rifle and Pistol Club South. And so I've got a few people together, and we're going to, starting in January of 2018, we're going to put something together where we open up a chapter here.
So tell us why you think it's important. A lot of folks who come from the traditional gun culture, which is primarily white, may question the need for a gun club that targets black gun owners and black folks who may be interested in guns. Why do you think that's important? Why can't black people just come to the regular gun club meeting with the other white people?
Well, several reasons. first of all, they don't see a lot of them there. They don't see a lot of African Americans in the gun culture. Also, there's a strong conservative element in the gun culture that I think a lot of African Americans tend to shy away from. And I think that I have a company that, you know, trains anybody, and in most of my marketing, I use African Americans to encourage them to come out. And yet, even with that, I still seems like I need to, you know, black people are more open to the concept of joining a club than they are just going out and getting training. And I think that there's historical reasons for that. You know, it just seems that the social aspects of doing it in a environment where somebody's actually trying to bring them in, you know, they seem to respond better to that.
The ultimate goal with black gun clubs, is it to bring black folks into the culture and remain separate? Or is there a bridge at some point where the two communities can come together?
The goal ultimately is to integrate as many African Americans as possible into the Second Amendment community overall, because the Second Amendment is not going to be saved by just white people. You know, we have to get other groups of people, other minorities of all types, into the Second Amendment community, or we're going to have some problems going forward. That's the goal. We hope that that's the case, but I think that America in general and its racial culture in America in general, it will be something that will, there's aspects of it that will have to be overcome to make that a reality, I think, on a large scale.
Speaking as a Black gun owner, a Black student of the firearm, and a Black instructor, I can relate to the difficulties that arise sometimes in communicating, in articulating to non-Black gun folks just how difficult it can be navigating this space. And it's exacerbating because sometimes I feel like I haven't done a good job putting it into words and helping folks to understand why there is a need for affinity clubs and why we have to take special measures to pull Black folks in. And I recently attended a training, one of your training courses where I'm going to put you on the spot here. So I was in your training course, and in the course of teaching us something on the line, you quoted a line from a song by Mobb Deep. And at that moment, I was like, yes, someone who understands me. So I mean, you and I have had this conversation about what a relief it is to feel that kind of cultural connection to people who are imparting knowledge to you, because that enhances the level of trust and helps people to let their guard down. But if I were to give that story to your average white trainer, I could understand there being a sense of kind of, you know, helplessness. You may not have to learn Mobb Deep lyrics in order to reach out to Black people. Is it that simple, or is there a better way that we can explain to folks why it's important to be cognizant of these small little nuances that might be alienating people even when we don't realize it or don't intend to do so?
I agree. You don't have to quote Mobb Deep, but you know, what you can do is be careful what you do quote, and be careful that there are some cultural sensitivities, and that you may when you're speaking, for example, when you say liberal, mm-hmm. you know, when you say Democrat, you know, saying if you're disparaging Democrats in your class, you know, you might want to be careful that you may be alienating certain people. One thing that I think the Second Amendment community, I don't think the Second Amendment community has done as good a job as it could in outreach. Mm-hmm. You know, to let them know that it is okay to come close, you know, that even if we do disagree, even if I am, for example, a hardcore Republican, a conservative, that it's still very important for me that you be able to exercise your Second Amendment rights, you know, mm-hmm. because I don't think that the subculture, which is what African-American culture is, it is the subculture, knows that it is okay to approach even. And if you think historically speaking, if you look at America's history, there's a good reason for that, you know, that, you know, we, I mean, there's been things that we have been excluded from, and we may not know that it's okay now to come close and to deal with, to, you know, to deal with those things in that nature, especially when it comes to firearms. Firearms have been explicitly denied to Black people for hundreds of years in this country. And it's something that's just recently changed in the last few decades, to be honest. And so that's, being that that's new, that's something that we really have to use. The Second Amendment community has to reach out and tell them it's okay. You need this, and you need to be a part of this, and we need you.
So what advice would you give to Black folks who subscribe to the narrative that guns are a scourge in the Black community and are contributing to our downfall as African Americans?
I think they need to take into consideration where we are getting that advice from, and to really consider that maybe that firearms are being used as a scapegoat, more or less, that the problems in the African American community run a lot deeper. I mean, it used to bother me to think that, okay, so you go out in the rural areas, you know, where they, let's say that there's less, you know, African Americans, and they got guns all over the place, and they don't have the crime problem. They don't have the killing. But you come into the inner city, and we've got all this killing. So is that there's something wrong with African Americans? Put a gun in our hand and we just have this, you know, this genetic predisposition to go out and kill each other? You know, no. So what's behind it? Is lack of employment opportunities behind it? Is the drug thing behind it? You know, is the drug narco economy, is that behind it? Is gangs behind it? What other deeper social ills are manifesting themselves in gun violence? Because the gun is just a tool, you know. So I would exhort Black people, the African Americans, to look and say, okay, well, why is this? Look deeper than just somebody else telling us, hey, you know, guns are a problem, get rid of them. And for a very big reason, the basis of gun control is that the government and law enforcement will be responsive and benevolent. And that's not the African-American experience. You know, even now, we have issues with, you know, African-Americans and police relations in urban areas. When we're saying, hey, then, you know, we outsource our our safety to these elements, is that really the best idea? You know, and maybe we should really think about that again.
And the issue of policing in minority communities or in Black communities is a whole different topic that probably would justify a segment unto itself. So maybe I can convince you to come back one day and talk about that, since you do come from a law enforcement background. And I think you've got some really interesting perspective on community policing and what is required of police officers who truly want to protect and serve across all demographics. So hopefully you can come back and we can talk about that another time. Fair enough?
Fair enough.
Now, if anyone wants to reach you, is interested in your company or training with you, where can they find you?
Citizenssafety.com.
Well, thank you so much for your time. I won't keep you any longer. I look forward to talking to you again. And hopefully maybe we can get your dad in here to talk about starting the first Dory Miller Gun Club back in the 80s.
Yeah, if you can catch him awake, I'm sure he'll be happy.
Excellent. All right, you take care.
Take care now.
You can follow Tiffany at frontsightpress.com.
Cerakote is a polymer ceramic composite coating that can be applied to metals, plastics, polymers, and wood. It's also what will take your plain Jane firearm from basic to full custom. Whether you want a handgun coated in just a single color, your hunting rifle camouflaged for your specific environment, or your competition pistol sprayed in purple, white, and black Carolina Cryptic, you want Carolina ceramic coating to do the job. Bud and his team of skilled technicians will carefully disassemble and clean your firearm, professionally apply the Cerakote in your choice of colors and patterns, and return your firearm to you in perfect working order. And they also do auto engine parts. When I wanted my competition handgun Cerakoted, I trusted Carolina Ceramic Coating, and you should too. Check out their work on Instagram. Search at CerakoteNC. That's at CERAKOTENC. Or go to CarolinaCeramicCoating.com. And now it's time for Blue Collar Prepping with that bratty kid sister of the gun blogosphere, Erin Paulette.
Come on, every pony! It's time for Blue Collar Prepping with Erin Paulette!
As I mentioned in the introduction, I received an air rifle, a Gamma Wildcat Whisper, from my friend Charles Lee Scudder. While not strictly necessary, an air rifle is something very nice to have in your preps for a variety of reasons. They are inexpensive. A decent air rifle costs between $100 and $150, depending on what options you choose. So is the ammunition. The most common caliber for air rifles is 177. From now on, I'll just call this 17, okay? And this stuff is ridiculously cheap. 500 rounds of 17 cost about $6. Because of this, you can practice a perishable skill economically. Air guns are better than even 22 long rifle in that regard. It's a good training platform for children. The rifles are light, there's no recoil, and there's no bang, which means there's no startle reflex to overcome. They're quiet. When I used mine in the backyard, the only sound I could hear was the ping from the pellet hitting the trap. My mother, who was about 20 feet away inside the house, couldn't hear it at all. This means that you don't have to go to a range to practice. You can practice in your yard or inside your home, so long as you have a good backstop. It's not a legal firearm. This means that you can buy it online, have it delivered to your home, and there's no paperwork to fill out. Although, this may be different if you live in Canada. So when considering an air rifle for purchase, there are two big choices to make: caliber and action. While there are actually four popular airgun calibers, 17, 20, 22, and 25, to my mind, there are only two worth considering due to their availability and effectiveness, 17 and 22. 17 caliber is cheaper, more readily available in stores, and comes in a variety of ammo types: greater penetration, greater impact, greater expansion, and match grade for practice and competition. It's also a flatter shooting round. 22 caliber pellets are slightly harder to find in stores and cost about twice as much, but they have much more impact when used for hunting. Ultimately, caliber choice comes down to what you want your rifle to do. If you want to hunt with it, you should get a 22, because a 17 is likely to pass through an animal without killing it, allowing it to run away and die later. If you want it for practice or for training, get a 17. If you plan to use it for vermin control, either caliber will do, although 17 is probably more cost-effective. When it comes to what kind of action to use, your choices are CO2 cartridge versus pump. CO2 rifles are easier to use and faster to shoot, because you won't have to pump the rifle up after each shot, but they add another consumable to your preps and an extra layer of complication. Pumps are slower to load, and it can be a pain in the rear to unshoulder the rifle, put the buttstock on the ground, break the barrel open, load the pellet, close the barrel, reshoulder, and fire. But they also have fewer complicated parts, and all you need are the pellets. For this reason, I recommend pump-action rifles for preppers. When it comes to pump actions, there are different choices, but this risks getting into the weeds of brake barrel versus pneumatics. For those who are interested in learning more about air rifles, please check the show notes for a link to a Blue Collar Prepping article on air rifles. Give it a read.
Weird brings us part two of the interview with criminologist Tom Gabor in This Week in Anti-Gun Nuttery.
Okay, here's part two of the interview with criminologist Thomas Gabor from the one and only anti-gun podcast, Loaded Conversations. So let's just dive right in with Dr. Gabor showing his objective nature by maligning all gun owners.
Yet when we look at the shooters, whether shooters in a domestic situation, whether people who shoot themselves, people who shoot others accidentally, frequently these are not people with criminal records and long rap sheets.
He's not lying here. We'll be getting those clips later. But he is being very intellectually dishonest. Frequently, I guess, could be interpreted as a majority of, and yes, the majority of gun deaths in America are suicides. And suicides by gun tend to be older people with clean criminal backgrounds. But he's lumping that number in with violent crime numbers. You listen every week to Sean's Felons Behaving Badly segment, and I think we all know that the people committing the violent crimes on the street or in domestic abuse are not upstanding citizens with clean criminal backgrounds. But when he phrases it this way, it makes it sound like every gun owner in America just might snap at any moment. While that isn't true, if you're trying to push a political agenda, it's a very useful fiction.
We know that suicide attempts using a firearm are about 90% successful. When we talk about certain types of pills and overdoses, we're looking at 2 or 3%.
Now put on your thinking cap. Suicides that involve a firearm are 90% fatal, and firearms amount to about half the total suicide methods in the country. Yet other methods, he's not clear if that means all other methods or just a handpicked few, are 3% fatal. Seems like there are massive numbers of unsuccessful suicides going on if this number is true. Here's the ugly truth. Not all suicide attempts are equal. Some are indeed somebody attempting to end their life and falling short, but many are cries for help. I have friends and acquaintances who have ended their lives, as well as friends and acquaintances who have made the attempt to do so. Many of those attempts were calculated to ensure they were discovered and given the help they needed. I'm not belittling that. Someone harming themselves is a serious matter, and these people need help and should get it. But Dr. Gabor is somehow implying that guns cause suicide. And if we can ban guns, we can eliminate or reduce suicide in America. Or actually, even more foolishly, he's saying that if we ban guns, suicide will stay the same, just the success rate will plummet. Except the United States is about middle of the road when it comes to suicide rate, even compared to countries that have almost completely banned personal firearms. The most gun-unfriendly state in the Union, the vast majority of our suicides are done by hanging, asphyxiation, or poisoning. Then he attempts to play the without guns, crimes wouldn't be so deadly card.
And if people don't have access to a firearm, they may use another weapon that's much less likely to result in the death of a victim.
Cool story, bro. But there's never been a restriction of firearm ownership that has been linked to a decrease in crime. Hell, just look across the pond to Scotland. Scotland has been one of the most violent places in Western Europe since recorded history. Depending on how you count, it has a higher violent crime rate than the United States. Even when firearms came into the world, the Scots never much cared for them, and still to this day, they murder each other at a rate higher than the rest of Western Europe, but they do it with hands, feet, blunt instruments, and knives.
Protective use of firearms has been promoted so strongly by the gun lobby. Hunting has declined tremendously in America, as has target shooting in general. And there are a number of reasons for this.
Okay, there is some debate whether hunting is on the decline in America. I would argue that the number of flyers, catalogs, and emails I get from places like L.L. Bean's, Cabela's, Dick's, Midway USA, and Brownells would be pretty wasteful doing all that marketing for an industry that's nearly dead. That being said, I would love to kill a deer, They're dangerous to motorists, and they taste great. Plus, I enjoy a walk in the woods as much as the next guy. That being said, I've never been proper hunting in my entire life. Why? Because to do it legally is a pain in the butt. It's not like fishing where I can just walk to the ocean and wet my line, or walk to a corner store or town office and get my license and find any old public pond or waterway to throw a lure. Meanwhile, I belong to a gun club that has a few 24-hour indoor ranges, and I've been there from early in the morning to late at night and on weekdays and weekends. Recently, I've taken to avoid weekends because it's so crowded. And we're talking Massachusetts, where it takes more effort to get a permit to buy a gun than it takes for most states to actually get your license to carry. So another statement that just isn't true.
Some people are buying multiple firearms, which is a real concern.
Why? I've never got this thing that anti-gun nuts seem to have about buying multiple firearms. It's not like criminals have big collections. Most spree shooters have 1 to 4 guns, and most of these are simply bought within the time they were planning their attack. The Las Vegas shooter had a ton of guns in his hotel room, but there's no way he even used half of them. But again, he's trying to malign shooters, hunters, and collectors who own lots of different guns. Maybe he thinks that somehow every gun you own saps a little bit of your humanity. Eventually, once you have a dozen or so guns, you aren't even recognizable as the same species as him. Gun owners are the enemy, and he must turn everybody he can against them by painting us as unhinged psychos.
Hillary Clinton, when it looked like she would be president back in August of 2016, there was a real spike in gun sales again, and she was more vocal about not seizing guns, but about some gun violence prevention measures.
Hillary Clinton was the most anti-gun presidential candidate in the history of America, but she wasn't talking about seizing guns?
Certainly the Australian example is worth looking at.
The Supreme Court is wrong on the Second Amendment.
Australia had a mandatory buyback of most guns in the country, and you wonder why people were panic buying guns.
Bogus bill, it's called the National Hearing Protection Act.
So bogus. I'm so glad you said that.
Exactly. That's being, you know, introduced under the pretext that we have to protect the hearing.
So bogus. One shot without ear protection, be it from forgetting to put on your protection between shooting strings, or from a plug popping out, or something like a rifle stock breaking the seal on your earmuffs, can lead to permanent hearing damage. And that's just sports shooting. If you're doing any activity with a gun where you need your hearing, say hunting or personal protection, if you shoot, you're guaranteed to damage your ears. Bogus indeed.
When people are allowed more freely to buy silencers, they often will also have to buy another gun. Yeah. Why? Because you need these threaded barrels to put on the silencer.
You gotta love these gun experts. He's trying to make the argument that the Hearing Protection Act is a demand from the gun industry to drive up gun sales rather than a need that the people want filled. All you have to do is look at the number of suppressor registrations in the last few years to see how false that is. Further, Tom is such an expert, he doesn't even seem to realize that most rifles and target guns are being sold with threaded barrels these days. And for a suppressed pistol, most major makers have a suppressor-ready version of most of their best sellers, and a threaded barrel is a relatively inexpensive purchase. Now he closes out on concealed carry, which, as you can guess, he's opposed to as well.
The FBI, you may be familiar with this, conducted a study of active shooter incidents. 160 active shooter incidents where there was an opportunity, you know, an active crime scene, an opportunity to take down the shooter. Only in 1 out of 160 cases did an armed civilian intervene successfully. It turns out he had a military background.
For those who didn't hear it, I invite you to listen to my segment I did back in episode 106, where I tackled this issue. First, I noted that John Laud has a rather large list of potential mass shooters who were stopped by an armed citizen. As I said before, you certainly can argue that maybe some of those attackers might not have attempted mass murder if they weren't confronted, but it would be nearly impossible to refute all of them. Of course, recently we had the mass murder in Sutherland Springs, Texas, where the killer was stopped and killed by a private citizen with an AR-15. I will note that Dr. Gabor thinks that AR-15s are weapons of war and need to be banned. I also looked into the very FBI report Dr. Gabor is citing. I found that out of the 160 cited mass shootings, 57% of the locations were in areas that either banned concealed carry or had heavy restrictions on concealed carry, with an additional 27.5% of the locations were on company grounds where employees are banned from carrying, though these locations certainly don't prevent customers and outside parties from carrying. So not only is the number much bigger than the numbers cited, But the data is clear. Spree killers seek out areas where they know the number of people who could fight back is limited.
We require licensing of cars, licensing for many professions. We're looking at a lethal weapon here. Now, some states have adopted permitting, you know, for people who purchase firearms, and that's been successful in reducing rates of homicide.
So many lies in one spot. First up, we license and register cars, but only cars driven in public roads. Even with all that regulation, vehicular deaths are higher than guns everywhere. Also, while nearly all gun deaths are intentional acts, most auto fatalities are accidents. Yeah, that's right. More people are killed by accident with cars than on purpose with a gun. To tear more of this garbage apart, I have a link to Law Dog's rebuttal of this foolish argument in the show notes. He also talks about states like Massachusetts and Illinois that license gun ownership. Not only is that illegal under the Second Amendment, I've spoken to Alan Gurr about it and he's more than willing to take the case up in the future, but never has it resulted in less violent crime in the state. Antis like to point out studies that show certain gun-friendly states have high gun homicide, while anti-gun states have a lower homicide rate. Of course, ignoring California, Illinois, New Jersey, and Maryland. Those make the mistake of looking at a single moment in time. It wasn't very long ago where such licenses weren't allowed, and when the laws were passed, violent crime went up.
The Violence Policy Center has now documented close to 1,000 murders a year in the last 10 years by concealed carry weapons holders.
Oh boy, nothing like citing the VPC to support your learned argument. Clayton Kramer wrote a whole paper on their crappy little concealed carry killers list. To sum it up, like all anti-gun hit pieces, it relies heavily on suicides. So Bob Owens from BearingArms.com is a concealed carry killer because he held a valid permit and ended his own life. They also cite a large number of cases where the trial is pending or the shooting was already ruled as justified. And of course, being a bunch of nuts, their methods are very shoddy, likely leading to double counts and data errors. Hey, but if Dr. Gabor wants to hang his reputation off that crap, it certainly would be appropriate given how tenuous his relationship with the truth is.
We've seen so many police officers, you know, in recent years that have been filmed or videoed, you know, making mistakes, making deadly mistakes. These are people who are trained on an ongoing basis. Our citizenry are not getting trained.
Except can he cite similar mistakes done by concealed carry permit holders? He implies that police are more trained than the average citizen with a concealed carry permit. Citation needed for that one, Tommy. And that since cops shoot people who don't need to be shot, armed citizens clearly must be shooting people at a higher rate than the cops. Except they aren't. Dr. Thomas Gabor is little more than a blowhard filled with bad faith arguments.
In addition to appearing here, Weird is a regular host on The Squirrel Report and blogs at weirdworld.com. That's weerdworld.com.
Plug of the week, Silver Spoon.
So the 1980s comedy starring Ricky Schroeder?
I really liked Silver Spoons, but that was spoons plural. This is Silver Spoon singular, and it's actually a Russian cop drama, like police procedural, and it is freaking awesome. It's got basically this dude who's a rich kid in Russia. He lives in Moscow. He parties all the time. His buddy is a drunk and a drug dealer. He's apparently a drunk. He's going to marry his buddy's sister and he's going to have this kind of cool life. His buddy takes a bunch of drugs and he's like trying to get him not to drive his car, and they end up screwing off, getting pulled over by the cops, getting into a fight with the police officer and losing one of the cop's guns, which becomes important later in the story. Well, his father, the main character's father, gets mad at him. He's a Russian oligarch, billionaire dude. And he's like, you're going to have to get a job and you're going to work wherever I tell you. And if you can do it for a year, then I'll give you your money back. Puts him to work as a cop in the same exact unit as the two guys he got into a fight with the night before, which you can imagine how happy they are to see him. It's this fish out of water story of this Russian oligarch's son who's done nothing but party and drink, and he went to law school, but he probably bought his law degree. He didn't actually like study for it or anything. And now he has to act as a police officer. For some strange reason, he decides that if he's going to be a police officer, he's going to try to do a decent job. I think it has something to do with the fact that his police captain, who's the leader of the little four-man unit that he's part of, is absolutely stunning Captain Radionova. You have to see her to believe her. She's beautiful. The dude who plays the main character's father, he's a Russian oligarch, he looks like a slightly fatter Nathan Fillion when you watch him. You see like still shots of him, you don't quite see it, but you see him acting and being this character, and it looks like Nathan Fillion to me. And then, like, my favorite character of the characters he's not like a main character. He's the person who's in charge. Have you ever noticed, Aaron, on cop shows, they always have the captain who's like a jerk. He's always screaming at everybody.
You're out of control, McBain. One more and I'll have your badge for this.
Yeah, exactly. Well, there's something about Russians and doing the whole brooding, long-suffering look. There's a police lieutenant colonel. Like, he's Radionova's boss, right? And they're forever ending up in his office. And he's got that look on his face, that fatherly look of, why do you kids do this to me? You know, and I'm proud of the work you do, so I can't kill you all. But right now I feel like killing you all. That's kind of what you get out of him. And I just feel so sympathetic to this guy. Like, he's got the worst job in the world being in charge of these yahoos. Except they do good work. And then they act like idiots. And it's been 12 episodes. I binge-watched the entire first season. It's freaking awesome. There is an advantage to it being in Russian with subtitles. You're going to see some stuff and you're going to say, that's stupid. Nobody would ever do that. But you always have the out of, ah, but it's Russia. Maybe that's okay in Russia. So, like, it really helps with the suspension of disbelief. There's a whole lot of shooting at fleeing felons. And trust me, they do not have all six of Masad Ayoub's list of factors that have to be present to shoot at fleeing felons. It's just like, we're tired of chasing them, so we're going to shoot at them. It's bad. I'm like, the stuff that happens in this, you're like civil libertarian nightmare. Radley Balco would slip a gear and poop out a kidney. I'm like, it's just bad. They don't actually take anybody into a back room and beat him with rubber hoses, but the interrogations happen in their office. Like, they don't have like a bullpen or something. They call something a bullpen, but I don't know what the bullpen is. They don't take him into an interrogation room or anything. No, they just take him into the office and yell at them around their little office desk. And some of it is just like, that's dumb. They would never do that. Well, you know, it is Russia. Maybe they do. I don't know. But you end up really liking all of the characters in their own various ways. They're all idiots and they're all great. You know, you don't have that one character who's like super good at everything. And, you know, like a Mary Sue. You don't have a Mary Sue character. They just have a bunch of really screwed up people who are trying to do a good job. And they variously succeed at that.
So I suppose you could say they bumble well.
That's the thing. They're not bumbling. They're not just like, oh, duh, how did that happen? But they're trying. And sometimes they run into justice backwards. You know, they don't actually intend to get where they're going, but they get there. And this poor lieutenant colonel who's in charge of all of them, you could understand if he was an alcoholic, but apparently he isn't. It's like the one person on the show that doesn't drink.
Wow, playing against type.
I don't know. I mean, maybe he does. He does tell the dude after he shoots the first person he's ever shot in his life and kills him. He says, go home and get drunk. And the kid's like, I can't. I drink too much as it is. I need to stop drinking. He's like, well, it always worked for me. But I love this character. I mean, he's just awesome. I don't know where he came up with that. Because usually they're like overbearing yelling jerks, right? Not this guy. Mm-hmm. He yells. Oh, yeah, he yells. But it's, you can see it's like, you know, you remember the times where your dad yelled at you and you could tell he really didn't want to yell because he was sort of proud of you and sort of wanted to kill you all at the same time. That's kind of what it is. So check it out. It's Silver Spoon. It streams on Netflix. There's two seasons up. I've watched the first 12 episodes, which is season one, and it's great.
Well, I know what you're going to do next week on your vacation. You're going to finish the second season.
Actually, I think I'm going to move on for a little bit and watch Godless. Because it has my favorite actress in it.
Michelle Dockery?
Yes, it does. So, quick reminder, join Gunblog Varietycast Radio Group on Facebook. Well, that's our show for the week. Remember that Gunblog Varietycast Radio is a member of the Self-Defense Radio Network.
Find the show notes at gunblogvarietycast.com/episode171.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Gun Blog Variety Cast. Music courtesy of Rob Allen at blog.roballen.com. You can subscribe to this podcast on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, and Google Play Music. This podcast is made possible by the Firearms Policy Coalition and by contributions from listeners like you.
But I gotta say, I'm starting to like this Captain Radyanova. You know, we can get her on an English language role. She might pass Michelle Dockery.
Oh, okay. Duly noted.
This is a URS production.